is a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. That big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. So let them eat jelly beans, let them eat cake, let them eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. President wants to admit it or not. You can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo, look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
Damn right. Ain't it the truth? This terrible Tommy here in the bunker. Right here in the Robert Matthews Memorial Bunker. And it is the 13th of March, 2014. Took me a minute to get that out there, a few seconds. Hey, this is Thursday. Thursday. Boy, I really like that McMurtry. Yeah, James McMurtry. He's a terrific singer. He puts the right words together, too. Well, let's start off with an excellent call we received in here. And if you'll call in on our national line, which is 559-670-1473, and put a good message on there about what's going on in your area and what's going on and what you think about what's going on, we'll put it on the radio show.
It's pretty obvious what's going on with the Ukraine right now. The Western powers, led of course by Washington, Zog on the Potomac. They want to bring the Ukraine, they want to turn it into a NATO puppet state and use it to help surround Russia and intimidate Russia into submission. And, if the Western powers think they can intimidate Russia into submission, they're really stupid and foolish, because that's not going to happen. So I'm glad the Russians are reasserting themselves. They've really got no choice in this situation. They've got troops going into the Crimea right now to reincorporate that area back into Russia. And seems a lot of Ukrainians in the eastern part of Ukraine are very happy to be liberated by the Russians. They don't want to be part of the – they don't want to be a NATO puppet state. They don't want to be part of the EU. And so I'm glad Russia is asserting its sphere of influence and its right to defend its interests and come to the assistance of its allies. But it's really shameful the way the right wing in this country, the neocons, the right wing, they're still fighting the Cold War. You know, they still got this pathological hatred of Russia. Of course, when Boris Yeltsin was in charge, when he was the buffoon in charge of Russia, he just fell down drunk on the floor and let the Jews and the plutocrats and the speculators and walk all over him and take advantage of Russia. But Putin is he's not the great nationalist hero that we all wish he was, or the great pro-white defender of Slavic nationalism that we wish he was, but he's better than Yeltsin, that's for sure. You know, he doesn't let himself get pushed around by the by Wall Street or the international capitalists, the speculators, you know. So I give credit where it's due, and I'm glad that somebody's standing up to Western aggression, you know, in the Ukraine. I wish the Ukrainians all the best of luck, but they need to stay with Russia. And, you know, Russia needs the Ukraine as a barrier against Western imperialism. And one more thing, if time permits. I've noticed the liberals and the Jews are they're no longer really interested in using blacks as their mascot, you know, or as their weapon or tool against whitey the way they used to. I think they're getting tired of blacks and, I think the Jews and the liberals seem more interested in using homosexuals now as a tool against West or a weapon against Western civilization. If you'll notice, over the past few years, there's been, this so-called gay rights nonsense has just come out of nowhere. It's a very well-funded and well-orchestrated campaign, of course. This has nothing to do with, it's not spontaneous, it's not grassroots. It's very well funded, very well organized, and it's all part of a grand strategy to destroy Western civilization. But I guess using blacks as a weapon against white civilization wasn't really working out too well. So they weren't doing the best possible job to undermine Western civilization. So now homosexuals and so-called gay rights are being used as a weapon against by the social Marxists, the cultural communists, to destroy Western civilization. I'm sure you've noticed that. So blacks are no longer needed. They're no longer being exploited or taken advantage of by the social Marxists the way they used to. Being queer or being queer is all the rage nowadays, and using queers as a tool against Western civilization that seems to be the weapon, the preferred weapon of the cultural Marxists, the social communists. So those are my 2 billion observations for this week. Thanks for your great message as usual. So long.
So there you go. Another report from one of our friends out there in the Netherlands. Well, on the Stray Dog show the other day, we talked about using some DDT and how they'd banned it all over the place. And I thought they'd had banned it in the third world, but an update on that is DDT, although long banned in the U.S., Canada, and Europe, DDT is still manufactured and used in other countries around the world today. China still manufactured it as late as 2007, and India still manufactures it as of 2014. It is mostly used today in India and Africa, where it is widely used against mosquitoes for malaria control. Well, thank you for that. Well, here's another that's wasteful story. An alleged white supremacist woman accused of killing 4 people during a violent road trip across the Pacific Northwest with her boyfriend pleaded guilty on Tuesday to racketeering in a deal that could send her to prison for life. Federal prosecutors said Grigsby, in her late 20s, is due to be sentenced in June. The couple were arrested in 2011 in Northern California after the authorities described as a bloody 2-week crime spree that began in the Puget Sound city of Everett, Washington, with the slayings of boyfriend David Joseph Peterson's father and stepmother. Well, let's see here. The 3-state road trip, during which the duo are accused of killing a middle-aged black man and a 19-year-old stranger, singled out because they thought he was Jewish, ended up with, and Grigsby allegedly telling police she and Peterson were on their way to kill more Jews in Sacramento, California. Oh, man. Peterson is scheduled to go on trial in July in Portland on federal racketeering and other charges linked to the case, Wright, racketeering. The 24-page federal indictment says Peterson researched the names and addresses of Jewish organizations in Seattle, Portland, Sacramento to identify potential targets for elimination, and that he had drafted press release to alert the media about the purpose of the planned murders. The indictment describes their purpose as promoting and advancing a white supremacist movement to purify and preserve the white race and reclaim our country. Boy, what a waste that is. Now, you wonder how that got started. I can think of a lot of people, oh man, wasting their whole lives on just going after some strangers. That's not the way revolution works. Please. Now, they say they were connected to a criminal organization, but they don't mention what that criminal organization was. That's how they brought in these other charges. That's an interesting case. What a waste. Now I'm going to run a clip that I got off NPR that's very interesting and covers a lot of things I've said over the years about the history, World War I, World War II, and all that kind of stuff. And pay special attention to where it talks about the rabbis being so upset in Germany because the German Jews were integrating into German society and so forth to what they considered a dangerous point for the rabbis.
Two shots fired 100 years ago claimed 2 lives and an entire century. The bullets fired in Sarajevo in June 1914 killed the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and his wife. The assassination propelled the world into war. The war left millions dead, it shattered empires, and it rearranged power throughout the world. What if the assassin in Sarajevo had missed? What if, like his small band of amateur co-conspirators, he didn't hit his target? It's hardly unthinkable. Moments before the murder, Franz Ferdinand's car made a wrong turn, and it came to a stop right in front of the gunman. So, what if Franz Ferdinand had lived? What if the urgent cable that day had been a little less urgent?
Telegram to the editor of the New York World, Sarajevo, Bosnia-Herzegovina. Police here report a gunman in custody after an attempt on Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary this afternoon. The Archduke returned to Vienna to prepare for next...
Without the assassination, no need for rulers in Vienna to threaten Serbia. No need for Russia to come to Serbia's defense. No need for Germany to come to Austria's defense. And no call for France and Britain to honor their treaties with Russia. What would be the ripples of this counter-history? Well, that's the premise of what we'll explore in this segment of the program.
World War I was the dominant event of the 20th century.
This is Richard Ned Lebeau. His book, Archduke Franz Ferdinand Lives, inspires us to tell this counterfactual, perhaps playful history of the last 100 years. Lebeau is a professor of international political theory at King's College London. It's his contention that if the Archduke had lived, no war would have occurred. That's a view that Christopher Clark shares. He's author of The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War.
None of the European great powers was planning to launch a war of aggression on any of its neighbors.
So to the extent that we can imagine a counterfactual history, it's not totally out of the ballpark to imagine a world in which the great powers of Europe didn't go to war in 1914.
Absolutely, and it's very interesting when you look at what the men who made the decisions in 1914, how they see the future. One thing that you can't help being struck by is how open the future seems to them. I mean, it's only from our perspective, in retrospect, when we look back, does that war appear to us inevitable, because there's something about big events which makes us believe in their unavoidability.
The Austro-Hungarian Empire had two capitals, Budapest and the more important one, Vienna. It was at the cutting edge of culture and science. Sigmund Freud was rewriting human psychology. Arnold Schoenberg was rearranging the musical scale. The Habsburg family had ruled the empire for centuries, with roots in the Holy Roman Empire. They were German-speaking Catholics ruling over a polyglot empire at the heart of Europe. Its leader in 1914 was Franz Josef, a man who had ruled the empire for 60 years. Margaret Macmillan, author of The War That Ended Peace, says that if there had been no war in 1914, the Austro-Hungarian Empire might have survived and evolved into a different sort of union.
Then you wouldn't have had an unstable Central Europe. You wouldn't have had a lot of quarreling states, which helped to contribute to the outbreak of the Second World War.
You might have had something like the League of Central European Nations, or the Central European Union.
Absolutely, and people talked about it at the time. They talked about a more voluntary association, and they talked about a common market or free trade area, which would have made a lot of sense if that had continued, because as soon as you got these different nations established in the wreckage of the First World War, you got tariff barriers going up, you got trade wars, and they all suffered.
So our counterfactual world is starting to take shape. With no World War I, we imagine a multinational successor to Austria-Hungary in Central Europe, maybe not the happiest country in Europe, but not a fratricidal one either. We handed this hypothetical ball to historian Christopher Clark, and he ran down the field with it. With no World War I, he figures, Tsarist Russia doesn't come completely undone. No World War I, and Germany of the 1920s is not bled by the victorious and vindictive Allies. The Nazis never come to power. And Christopher Clark reasons the role of Germany and German would have been greater.
Europe would have been a more German-speaking place, that the cultural authority of the German universities, which was quite extraordinary before 1914, might well have survived.
And Margaret Macmillan says a different natural alliance would have formed.
Germany was the biggest land power in Europe, it had the biggest army, and Britain was the great empire and had the biggest navy in the world. And so it was a very nice congruence of interests and powers. They were each other's largest trading partners. They shared a lot, including religion. The majority of religion in both countries was Protestant. Their royal families, of course, were intimately related. There were exchanges between universities. A lot of British young men went and studied in German universities. Four British cabinet ministers had graduated from German universities. And Germans came to British universities. German Rhodes Scholars came to Oxford, for example.
No world wars, and these royal cousins on the thrones of Germany and Britain would symbolize a powerful Anglo-German alliance. In his book, Richard Le Beau lets his imagination run with the world that didn't experience the Great War. In his counterfactual history, one Austrian veteran of the war, an aspiring artist and vegetarian, never goes to war, never enters politics, never rouses a rabble that was never reduced to wheelbarrows full of worthless paper money. Instead, Adolf Hitler pursues another career path.
Stymied as an artist, no chance of a political career, and of course no military experience by virtue of there being no World War I, he looks elsewhere and ends up becoming a manager of a company that produces alternative medicine.
And with Hitler reimagined flogging herbal remedies and aromatherapies, the Jews in Germany would continue to thrive, as Margaret Macmillan says they were thriving.
Jews in Germany were among the best integrated in Europe. I mean, a lot of German Jews were no longer practicing their religion. The chief rabbi in Germany, in fact, before 1914, was very worried that Judaism would eventually disappear in Germany because so many Jews were becoming integrated, losing their faith, or converting, or simply becoming atheists.
In this counter-historical world, there is no Holocaust. The small Jewish settlement in Palestine continues, but without a flood of refugees, it remains a minority community there. Without the First World War, Russia remains prosperous. And so, says historian Le Beau, the Bolshevik Party's October Revolution fails.
Lenin comes to the United States, where I imagine him assuming the position of a professor of Russian history at Columbia. And while he does this, he, of course, keeps alive contacts with left-wingers. This naturally brings him into contact with the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and the ILGWU is famous outside the labor world for having produced the musical Pins and Needles, and Lenin becomes one of their writers.
I'm on a campaign to make you mine. I'll picket you from pens you sign. It was a big union for two.
So a little more hot jazz, a lot less Cold War. In fact, as Margaret Macmillan imagines it, None at all.
We wouldn't have had the United States facing an utterly inimical ideology.
So, no system of mutually assured destruction, no divided Europe.
I think if Russia had remained in some ways a rather authoritarian monarchy, it would have been moving in a direction which would have brought it much closer to the United States. So I think we would not have had a Cold War, certainly not a Cold War in that form.
And with no World War I, no World War II, and no Cold War, this counterfactual world would know none of the occasional benefits of the Cold War.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Putting a man on the moon was very much a gesture, and it was to show that the United States had a science superior to that of the Soviet Union. And I don't think we would have had that.
More generally, without being harnessed to the mobilization for victory in world wars, science would have had a less dramatic century, according to Richard Laval.
In the absence of World War I, things develop much more slowly. We don't have safe aviation until much later in the 20th century. We don't have a polio vaccine until maybe 20 or 30 or 40 years later. Penicillin and other antibiotics came online in the 40s. This might have not happened until the 1960s. And, of course, the information revolution is even further delayed.
And perhaps no atomic bomb. We'll have some more counterfactual history tomorrow in the second and concluding part of this exercise. In the meantime, we invite you to imagine one aspect of the past century, politics, science, music, literature, anything, and how it might have been different if Archduke Franz Ferdinand had lived in 1914.
Well, if that wasn't clear enough for you, you can go to npr.org and find it. And I find that to be very stimulating, very interesting to think of what things would have turned out to be probably, or closer to what than what did turn out. And also that, like I said, my theory on this German Jewish situation is that the hierarchy of Judaism, probably the B'nai B'rith, were not very happy that Jews had integrated all over Germany and left the Jewish religion and all that kind of stuff, and many of them became atheists, and would they have gone to the extent of setting something up to where hundreds of thousands of them would die to bring them back into line? I know that seems like a very way out there theory, but more and more as I research, it's beginning to look like it very well could be. And the one another thing that I found quite interesting is that they didn't mention the fact that these two guys that shot the Crown Prince were anarchists. And isn't it quite interesting that two anarchists trigger a chain of events like a domino effect that build some of the biggest autocracies that ever, in the world, the dictatorships? And they were originally started out to knock off a couple of monarchs, but they ended up creating Stalin and Hitler and everybody. Think about it. So when you get to thinking about something you want to do, you better think it over very carefully before you try it, because you never know how it's going to turn out. Well, according to this, the incidence of anti-Jewish actions in the Netherlands is rising. Wow! Anti-Jewish incidents in Netherlands have been on the rise recently, according to a Dutch Jewish watchdog group. There's been a 23% increase in anti-Jewish incidents since 2012. The Center for Information and Documentation on Israel, known as CIDI, reported an increase of 33 incidents from 2012 to 2013, with a total of 147 incidents in 2013. These involved both physical violence and threats. Okay, now let's get down to what kind of threats these were. One incident in June 2013 involved an elderly man giving a Nazi salute to a Holocaust survivor. Quote, "They forgot to gas you," unquote, he reportedly told the Jewish woman, and proceeded to grab her Star of David necklace and bite her in front of witnesses. The occurrence was reported by police. Boy, that's a major incident. Anti-Jewish incidents in schools, including vandalism, what, with a marker pen, have more than doubled. The trend has infiltrated the cyber world as well, with the CIDI reporting 57 explicit anti-Jew Twitter messages. Wow. The commands are considered hate speech, or the comments are considered hate speech, and raise legal concerns. With thousands and tens of thousands of people dying all over the world and wars everywhere, and that's the best that the Jews can do to get sympathy? I think their sympathy card is about punched out. I think it's getting very, very weak. Well, Christians now have fallen in love with Queen Esther, Purim's Jewish heroine, according to the Jewish press. In recent novels, sermons, and Bible study guides, evangelicals and mainline Protestants alike find inspiration in the biblical tale. Yeah, check that biblical tale out. She got next to the king of Persia, a non-Jewish empire, and probably mostly white, and caused the death of thousands of Persians. Check it out. But now the Christians think it's great. In fact, Sarah Palin, yeah, she wanted to know all about Queen Esther. That's her hero. And she's got some very other interesting heroes of these black African voodoo ministers she brought up there to Alaska to her church. She's a whack job. The left wing's right about her. She's a whack job. Well, they've dug up some videotape of Yasser Arafat stating that he recognizes the Jewish state. Let's listen to this. Just a minute here.
The PNC has accepted two states, Palestinian state and Jewish state, between brackets, Israel.
Let's do that one more time. I'm not sure where that went through.
The PNC has accepted two states, Palestinian state and Jewish state, between brackets, Israel.
Well, that's what it sounded like to me, that there was a video with that. Of course, I can't show you that, but Yasser Arafat said recognizing the Palestinian state, I believe he said Palestinian state, and the Jewish state. So, now where do we go from there? I also see that Sarah Palin gave the keynote address at this CNET meeting, what, it was about a week ago. All weekend. I spent a lot of money on that. Well, the Republicans are going to fool around and put up another loser candidate. You wait and see. Who's going to leave the door wide open for the bitch Hillary? Hillary Clinton. Yeah, your next president. Well, let's check in with the rogue progressive for a minute here and see what's going on, see what he's got to say today.
By Jay Carney, as imposed by the Obama administration, expand the visa bans that had already been imposed on those considered responsible for human rights abuses and political oppression in Ukraine in recent months.
Spit it out.
Human rights abuses. Do we do that? We support torture. Yeah. The 10 top recipients of U.S. aid, as I pointed out last night.
Yeah.
Torture, imprison without charge, beat, boil alive.
But God loves us.
People they don't like. And we support, we give them billions of dollars.
Money's no object.
So we had already imposed restrictions and visa bans and all sorts of stuff on those responsible, it says here, for human rights abuses. Who puts visa bans and travel bans and freezes the bank accounts of American officials who are responsible for not just torture as we see fit to torture people, but countries that we specifically give billions of dollars to in order to handle our extraordinary rendition?
Uh-oh.
I should love that term.
What's that
and
mean?
And handle our torture.
Yeah.
Jesus God, this is insane.
Oh, yeah. Spit it out, Mike. Spit it out.
And there's more. In addition to the new restrictions, according to New York Times, President Obama also issued an executive order that provides the legal basis, see, has to come from an executive order, for imposing additional sanctions on, quote, individuals and entities, end quote, who have undermined Ukraine's territorial integrity. Sounds like they're just repeating themselves. How many visa bans and travel bans and bank accounts do you have to seize using the same rationale and using the same explanation? Who did this to the United States when the United States decided to attack, bomb, strafe, set fire to, invade, murder, kill, destroy hundreds of thousands of Iraqi men, women, and yes, children.
But God's with us.
Who did that to us?
Mike, God's with us.
I don't remember anybody, do you? The sanctions under this new Obama order could include freezing assets or preventing Americans from doing business with certain individuals. Ooh. When we attacked and slaughtered and murdered hundreds of thousands in Iraq, who was prevented, what countries prevented the United States business interests, the capitalists, the corporatists, from doing business in their countries? Anybody?
You un-American.
I don't remember. Do you?
You're un-American. Maybe you are.
In a statement from the Obama administration, probably delivered by Carney, I don't know, this. The executive order, quote, is a flexible tool that will allow us
tool.
To sanction those who are most directly involved in destabilizing Ukraine. Destabilizing? What did we do in Iraq? Is Iraq destabilized? Man.
Yeah, spit it out. Get it off your chest, man. I know.
The executive order to impose travel restrictions, visa restrictions, freeze bank accounts, and don't do business with them by the United States against Russians and Ukrainians, it says here, quote, is a flexible tool that will allow us to sanction those who are most directly involved in destabilizing Ukraine, including the military intervention in Crimea.
Yes.
And the White House statement added that this does not preclude further steps should the situation deteriorate.
Let's nuke those Ruskies.
Oh.
Come on. Be patriotic. God's with us. Nuke the Ruskies.
Man.
You got to get your mind right.
I don't know.
You sounded un-American.
And then there's this part of the report. Russian business and finance circles have been nervous since Monday. Give me more vodka! Where is my Valium? Unsure of what steps the United States and the European Union might take, said a former Kremlin advisor named Igor Yurgens, who now heads the Institute of Contemporary Development, a Moscow research organization. Mr. Yurgen said the text in the White House statement was so broad about what we're going to do to those Ruskies that it was unlikely to directly impact most major Russian businesses. In other words, we can't ignore this. This is crazy. This is United States talking crazy. We're just ignoring.
Hey, that boy's getting wound up again, I'll tell you. Talking very un-American here, boy. Sounds like he maybe a communist. Spit it out. Spit it out there, Mr. Progressive.
bottom, left to right, total corruption of our political system. And perhaps you were indulging the screaming Mike Malloy, and you said, well, okay, yeah, you know, there's some of that, but come on, Malloy, you're really overstating it. You're really overstating. Really? Well, after what was revealed today, after it turns out that the guy who filed the complaint with the Department of Justice that they're taking our files is the very same guy that provided lies to the Department of Justice that he now goes to about the torture program to begin with. What are you going to do with that reality? What kind, I mean, what do you appoint? A special prosecutor? An army of them? You know what you do in a situation like this? Do you know what will happen here? Let me tell you. Nothing. Nothing. Do you know what should happen? This whole government should collapse.
Oh, wow.
If this were any other government, the CIA would already be inside pushing in the pins and loosening the bolts to bring the whole goddamn thing down.
Don't hold back.
Do you realize where we are right now, where it concerns self-government in this country and the absolute corruption? I don't care if his name is John Boehner or Barack Obama or Dianne Feinstein or Ron Paul or Rand Paul. Every single one of these people. Corrupt to the bottoms of their feet. Now, if they didn't commit any crimes against the Constitution, and this is where it might get a little dodgy for some of you, they support a system that is corrupt, that is an attack on the Constitution, that has destroyed it. Conspiracy
Wow, man, I gotta cut you off before the feds come in here and pull me out of here, man. You're speaking all this un-American stuff, man, instead of being a Yankee Doodle Dandy. And I thought you were just a plain old liberal. You're a rogue progressive there. You're out of here for today. Maybe bring you back later. What do you say about it, Darth Vader?
Impressive.
What?
Impressive.
Oh, okay.
What is thy bidding, my master?
Well, we'll have to go on from here and find some new material. I got pretty well shaken up by that un-American type rogue progressive talk, calling our government a bunch of criminals and warmongers and talking good things about the Ruskies. Everybody knows we should nuke those guys. Yeah, should nuke them. Just like my Christian minister, he's a hellfire and brimstone boy. He said, we got nuked those Ruskies so Jesus can come back. Well, they got this big fight going on down in Indianapolis at the State House about same-gender marriage that they've come up with. I think they passed a law that is opposed to same-gender marriage. So now all the, I don't know what to call them, have gotten involved. And Eli Lilly, which is a big corporation that drugs up the country, over-the-counter drug addict supplier, and also the controller of politics in Indiana. If Eli Lilly doesn't back them, they don't get elected. And WellPoint and I don't know who this WellPoint Corporation is, takes a strong stand against Indiana's same-gender marriage ban. So that's going to be interesting to see how that cat fight turns out. But if Eli Lilly spends enough money or throws enough money at it and threatens enough of these Indiana politicians, they'll get rid of it. They'll get rid of it. Speaking about Indiana politics, let's go back here on... Read a little bit about the KKK leader back in the 20s, D.C. Stevenson. In 1925, David Curtis Stevenson was the most powerful man in Indiana. He owned the politicians up to and including the governor. He could send hundreds of hooded Klansmen marching through the streets. He could have a man beaten up or make him disappear. In November 1925, D.C. Stevenson was on trial for murder, and the chief witness against him was the murder victim herself, who on her deathbed had dictated her account. Well, there's a lot of disagreement about that particular trial and whether he was guilty or not. But the problem was the Klan in the 20s was not what the Klan was originated to be. It was sort of a neocon type organization. Yeah, sure, they marched around in their robes and stuff like that in parades, but the Klan was mostly working against bootleggers and stuff like that. And I wouldn't, if I'd lived at the time, I wouldn't have wanted them to got rid of the bootleggers. So it the Klan of the 20s back then, it got powerful because it was just sort of like a big club. People joined it to be for business contacts and so forth, like they do the Masons. So anyhow, that's I don't identify with that Klan at all. Well, we got a few minutes left in the show, so let's do a little go back to school again, okay? Come on in off the playground, boys and girls. Let's have a little class here. I've got as little class as anybody. Let's go back to our great book, Siege, by James Mason. Let's pick up here where we were talking about marked and unmarked. It is well to follow earlier segments with a word on how a truly revolutionary organization must be structured in order to be effective. Those of us having in our innocent youth been part of the mass strategy find ourselves now and forever marked by the catalogs of the FBI, CIA, ADL, and not to mention local police departments. Unless we as individuals decide in our own minds to disappear and slip underground alone to wage war against the system on what would probably be a one-way mission, we would be foolish to try to engage directly in armed struggle. To do so in spite of this truth for purposes of proving something to somebody falls directly in line with one of the key Zionist protocols, which states that the white man's greatest undoing has been a willingness to sacrifice a larger goal for a smaller, momentary one. We have absolutely no intention of rushing into their waiting open arms. And no, our new people will not be parading out in the streets in useless Phase One antics for the convenience of the system's catalogers. Neither shall they be monitored by post office checks of our mailings. Comrades of old, those of us who already are marked from years ago, who head the various cells around the country, will disseminate our propaganda person to person to those known only to themselves. Regarding the Phase 2 versus reality, these new people must not deliberately or at anyone's behest cause themselves to be separated from the mainstream of white America, either because of hairstyle, clothing, or any other stupid narrow consideration. They must be able to move about freely, accepted and unnoticed by their fellows if they're to be effective. Far from going out of our way to effect an invasion from Mars with Prussian tactics and appearance, as seems to be the goal in years past, we must effect a thorough infiltration of at least be able to infiltrate at will whenever and wherever the situation calls for it. Too many chiefs and no Indians has basically been the problem of the past. Those who insist most loudly upon being chief in the past usually turn out to be the least fit to hold the position. A true soldier simply understands his mission or duty and goes about doing it without fanfare. Being revolutionary soldiers, we must do what we are able to do and do it well. We each have function to fulfill. Circumstances, not wishful thinking, dictate these functions. As Joe Tomasi clearly stated, the leaders, the real chiefs, are those actually doing it, and we of the old school have been severely limited by the past itself. The greatest field of opportunities lies open to the newcomers, free of the hogwash, mistaken, and compromise of the past. However, one of the functions of the NSLF, National Socialist Liberation Front, above ground is to see to it that the revolution, once begun in earnest, is not betrayed. Let's start off on that road again. Recently, we've seen two men of action brought to a halt by what are the best referred to as White Uncle Toms. I believe it was a nurse at a blood bank who dime dropped on Joseph Franklin when she saw and recognized from reports a distinctive tattoo on Franklin's forearm as he was selling blood. The system in Buffalo, New York, believes they now have the 22 killer in custody after he was fingered by someone in Georgia he evidently thought he could confide in. These were not cases of infiltration, but rather the carelessness playing into the hands of countless millions of Uncle Toms, who are what this society is made up of. The Big Brother system, of course, operates as the master, with the goyish, nominally white consumers serving as slaves, of which the vast bulk are dyed-in-the-wool Uncle Tom types. Both Franklin and the 22 killer, or the Great White Hope of Buffalo, had it right and were encouraging, at least so far as they... I gotta change pages here. Insofar as they acted consistently alone, which is what solely provided the extent of success and longevity they did enjoy. We cannot forget the effect these men have had on helping to break the conditioned hothouse atmosphere and inject into the climate an air of revolution. NSLF knows that we must see the kind of society we are dealing with and understand it and realize that it can't be changed unless until the current order is done away with. Cognizant of all that, we then must make up in our minds to proceed appropriately. Allowing that, both these men, heroes actually, made the errors which undid them by taking too much for granted. As a movement, we cannot afford the same mistakes twice. As individuals, we can't afford even once. We can state again and again, never deal with the police. But you and I already know that. It is rather the rest of the total population which does not know it and never will know it. Not even when the police have become our police. They will never change their habits. Today, the casual citizen informant, the Uncle Tom, works terribly against us, but tomorrow they will provide the greatest ease and benefit. It is their nature to bow, scrape, and try by any means to integrate themselves or ingratiate themselves with the established authority and to inform on those designated as outlaws. Miserable, unthinking swine. Today it is us. Tomorrow it will be the race mixers, and so on. Until we establish ourselves as the only authority, we must, as revolutionaries and realists, accept the bitter anticipation of the sweet. It is sad commentary on the U.S. society when we compare to that of Northern Ireland, not an informant in the bunch, and that struggle is white versus white. Over here, we face the most odious enemy posing as a government ever in history, plus a monstrous black alien mass in our midst to be dealt with. Yet instead of Huey Long's concept of every man a king, it is rather every man an Uncle Tom. The armada of Uncle Toms is like unto better half of the system police already long existence. Even with their incredible sophistication, 1984 electronic surveillance techniques, the police simply could not function effectively without the citizenry working for Big Brother against themselves. We could romp them if the whites of the United States were what they ought to be, but they're not, and never are they likely to be. Seeing we cannot change that, we must instead adapt our tactics accordingly. we must become acutely aware at all times of the most minute details around us, overlooking nothing, taking nothing for granted. We must rigidly discipline ourselves to never, ever breathe a word about anything illegal to anyone, anytime, past, present, or future. Don't talk. Defeat Uncle Tom. Defeat Big Brother. And that is the end of our class today. Even though this book was written in the 80s, it's just as important, probably more important today than it was even then. Well, let's go along for another 5 minutes of that. Stupid people are more dangerous than any time bomb. You'll find stupid people everywhere, but let us confine ourselves to those within the movement itself, those whom we must deal with on a regular basis. Those armies of idiots within the system bureaucracy stand backed up and reinforced by so many replacements that errors of judgment on their part, which would otherwise prove fatal, are usually quickly caught and reversed before any damage gets done. Oftentimes, they're caught and squelched before anyone not part of the bureaucracy even can take note of them. It gives an aura of invincibility, but in fact provides for a deadly defect in that everyone is depending on everyone else to carry things through. There are plenty of Sharpies within the system, but not the same kind as are found in revolutionary movements, those that can do it all for themselves. The system needs their stupid people for errand boys, and so on, while we just cannot afford their presence at all. With us, things must stand or fall with just you and I, and that is the basis of real responsibility. Regardless whether they are with you or against you, stupid people are equally disastrous to have around. It is easy for anyone to imagine how stupid people can foul up and best plan or program and defeat the efforts of dozens of good and prudent people with whom they have associated themselves. But it is less easily understood what it means to have fools for adversaries. Again, I emphasize that we are dealing within the limits of the movement itself. I'd much rather run the risk of a tactical personal setback at the hands of a sharp, intelligent person, something I would expect I could reverse in time, than to have everything, the whole ball of wax, upturned or destroyed by some flake who loses all better judgment and control. And we all know how that goes on. We see it happen every once in a while. I'm not going to name any names. You don't need to name their names. By their works you shall know them. The very reason one falls out with persons of limited intelligence usually involves the same lack of vision, imagination, and discipline that will later lead them to tip the balance over from a local clash to a full-scale disaster, too often involving the system and threatening to destroy or seriously injure both participants. It's also hell to try to second-guess an unintelligent person. They are largely unpredictable and are liable to do anything. An intelligent adversary can most of the time be anticipated, and if not, it usually means that he's a jump or two ahead of you himself. He can be expected to fight things with at least protection, if not the immediate furtherance of the cause in his mind. A stupid individual won't care. They can see or understand nothing beyond the immediate object of "I'll show you." How often have we witnessed this in the right wing? How often have we seen it in personal affairs, and how the pigs laugh at it? Within the movement, within the struggle, whenever a person like this is uncovered and proceeds to threaten to disrupt things, he properly should be killed before any damage can be done. If that is not feasible, then it is critical to place as much distance between them and the movement or the struggle as possible. Same goes for personal dealings as well. Of course, in the long run, it's better to learn how to spot them in advance and never let them penetrate to a level where they can do no good and only harm. In this way, we shall forge ourselves into a truly formidable political weapon. July 1984. That's it for today from the great book Siege, and we'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, Friday, Ladies' Day, She-Wolf Day in the Bunker, 14-5, and we'll be back tomorrow.
I can remember us cruising through town in your daddy's car with the top pulled down, looking so cool. We came from different sides of the track, but we still held hands out back of the old school. We spent all our time together, laughing and having fun. We swore that we'd love forever, 'cause that was the way things were done at the old school. We both made it to our graduation. You chose a college, I chose a vocation, driving 18-wheel. I became a part of your past. You went and married some guy in your class, he was a big deal. Your picture was in all the papers. You made such a lovely bride. They said you were going places, but me, I just went for a ride down by the old school.
Old school.
I got married to a sweet young girl and kept driving for the line. Your husband made his mark on the world, then he left you behind in the big house with the swimming pool. Now you drive your kids down to the old school. Now here we are at the reunion of the class. You ask my wife if we could have one dance for the old times. We're slow dancing across the old gym floor. You whisper it could be just like before. Call me sometime. You ask if I understand you. Well, yes, I'm afraid I do. You say everybody does it, but I don't care if they do. I'm from the old.